It is again time for the New American Dream Radio Show. The American Russian novel, All We Need Is More Vodka Radio Hour. We have the winds of our own totalitarian society freezing the land solid, a tortured tundra.
What we must have is a new American dream. We are allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. A new American dream. Not of homes and toasters, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. The new America, the real hope of the world.
Some of those who have spoken the truth are no longer here. Their chairs at the Thanksgiving adult big table are empty. Their relatives have sent them to Siberia with a roll of their eyes. So let us begin. Here we go. Scooch up to the samovar. Maybe leave your hat and boots on. Fill your peasant hands with a warm drink and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
Lay back in an old saloon with a peso in my hand, just watching flies and children on the street. I catch a glimpse of black-eyed girls who giggle when I smile. This little boy wants to shine my feet. And it's 3 days' ride from Bakersfield. I don't know why I came. I guess I came to keep from paying dues. So instead I've got a bottle and a girl who's just 14 and a damn good case of the Mexicali blues. Yeah. Is there anything a man don't stand to lose if the devil wants to take it all away? Cherish well your thoughts, keep a tight grip on your booze, cause thinking and drinking are all I have today. She said her name was Billie Jean, she was fresh in town. I didn't know a stage line ran from hell. She had raven hair, a ruffled dress, a necklace made of gold, and all the French perfume you'd care to smell. She took me up into a room and whispered in my ear, go on, my friend, do anything you choose. Now I'm paying for those happy hours I spent there in her arms, a lifetime's work of Mexicali blues. Is there anything a man don't stand to lose when he lets a woman hold him in her hand? You just might find yourself out there on horseback in the dark, just riding and running across those desert stands. But a man rode into town, some thought he was the law, but Billie Jean was waiting when he came. She told me he would take her if I didn't use my gun, and I'd have no one but myself to blame. I went down to those dusty streets. Blood was on my mind. I guess that stranger hadn't heard the news. 'Cause I shot first and killed him. Lord, he didn't even draw. He made me trade the gallows for the Mexicali blues. Is there anything a man don't stand to lose when he lets a woman hold him in her hand? You just might find yourself out there on horseback in the dark, just riding and running across those desert sands. That song was written by John Perry Barlow, who died yesterday. He was quite a guy, a poet, lyricist, activist. Wrote a large number of songs for the Grateful Dead, of which Mexicali Blues was the first. Barlow graduated from Wesleyan University, as did I, and apparently he wrote this song there in 1972, one of the years that I was there, but I don't think I knew him. Barlow went on to found the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which tirelessly fights for internet freedom. And here's some great quotes from John Perry Barlow. Relying on the government to protect your privacy is like asking a peeping Tom to install your window blinds. The internet treats censorship as a malfunction and roots around it. We hope so. We will create a civilization of the mind in cyberspace. May it be more humane and fair than the world your governments have made before. John Perry Barlow will be missed. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio. It's a listener-supported network, and we'd certainly appreciate any donation you make to them over at revolution.radio or freedomslips.com. I am proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palacek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome these special guests, Richard Flamer, James Fetzer, Thomas Wortman, Frank Cordero, and Phil Ferruzio. So this Thursday evening, we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, in Cleveland, Ohio, in Des Moines, Iowa, in Port Orange, Florida, in Madison, Wisconsin, in San Cristobal de las Casas, Chiapas, Mexico, and wherever you are.
And now, Phil Ferruzio with It's the Empire, Stupid.
All right. Good evening, working stiffs. When will American labor connect the dots? You know, a few years ago in Wisconsin and in two major cities in California, the voters, made up mostly of working stiffs, chose to restrict the benefit packages and wage increases for public service, a.k.a. government employees. Now, some say that since most of the workers in these places and throughout America are employed by the private sector, the attitude became one of resentment. The private sector and non-union, in most cases workers, were fed up seeing their public sector counterparts getting better benefit packages and wage increases. Now, I call this inner class warfare. It's sad, isn't it? When the less than 1% of our nation can create such divisions within the labor force. Yet that was only part of the problem that the voting revealed. In Wisconsin, if you remember, the voters chose to side with a right-wing governor who was candid about his goal to eliminate collective bargaining within the public sector service. Now, this device cuts the leg off of the union movement, first with government workers and then copied by the private sector. Why was this all happening? Well, the answer is so obvious, yet our mainstream media and even many union leaders refused to recognize it. Former President Eisenhower labeled it the military-industrial complex, and it has all but bankrupted our economy. Within 13 years, our military spending has just about doubled. In 2011, under Mr. Hope and Change, taxpayers were charged 56 cents of every dollar we sent to Uncle Sam for military spending. Never before in the history of our nation has it ever approached such an amount. We have close to 1,000 permanent military bases in over 80 different countries. We illegally invaded and occupied Iraq and Afghanistan to the tune of over $100 billion tax dollars a year. A year. You know it cost about $1.2 million a year to keep one soldier in Afghanistan. That would pay the salaries of 30 teachers, 30 police officers, or 30 firemen at $40,000 a year. Where is the outrage? Historically, our Congress was able to send money to the states for their budgets and their cities' budgets problems. This was called revenue sharing. The money was sent to the states in the form of block grants, meaning it did not have to be paid back. That's pretty good, right? Well, that all ended with our devotion to invading countries and occupying them. That all ended with the fear button being pushed down the throats of the public, as we now have that with ISIL, who, by the way, are made up of many who were left homeless or devastated by the Bush gang's illegal and shameful attacks on their native lands. Both the Republican and the Democratic parties have enabled the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex to get more and more of our hard-earned tax dollars. Under Democratic President Obama, military spending soared to over $600 billion, and that did not include what many cite as the black budget, or money funneled into military programs which have no congressional oversight. It does not matter who occupies the White House. They all dance to the Pentagon Piper. The Congress and the presidency has, for the most part, been owned not only by Wall Street, but by this war empire. The phony demagogue who promised to drain the swamp is filling it with more money for the military as our cities and towns go down the rabbit hole. If only working, hardworking American labor force would take a moment to ponder. If the CEOs of our Fortune 100 companies are earning in excess of 400 times that of their lowest full-time employee, shouldn't we have a society whereupon all working stiffs have good benefit packages and wage increases? Let's extend that conversation and say that shouldn't all Americans have the same medical and dental coverage that those CEOs have? Now, I could go on and on, but let us leave it at that. If you work for a living anywhere, you should be allied with all your fellow working stiffs for fair wages and benefits. Isn't it time for what the Wobblies envisioned over 100 years ago? One big union. The bottom line is this. If we cut the military spending by even 25% and sent the savings back to the states, there would be no budget crisis in any state or city. Period. And for all my right-wing neighbors who bitch and moan about high property taxes, well, if more revenue sharing came back to our cities, perhaps then the property taxes needn't be so high. Stop supporting political parties and candidates who oppose such an idea. Thank you.
The February issue of Penn Magazine is now available at pennmagazine.us. Penn Magazine is named in honor of Penn Jones, Jr., one of the first honest researchers into the murder of John F. Kennedy. It's all connected. That day and this, there is an ongoing thread, and that's why it's important to keep doing the work. Because if truth does not come to the United States, it will implode and possibly destroy the world as well. So join with us, and let's save the world. The February issue of Penn Magazine features an article by Winston Wu, showing why the United States has never put men on the moon. The January issue of Penn Magazine features a piece by Craig McKee showing how the Boston bombers were framed. They didn't do it. It was a government psyop hoax event. Really, seriously. The December issue of Penn Magazine features a piece by James Tracy showing that we are being lied to about what really happened at Sandy Hook. It's all a part of a big game, a lie, toward what end we can only speculate. The first issue of Penn Magazine, launched in November 2017, featured a piece focusing on James Fetzer and Kevin Barrett, two honest journalists who are trying to tell us the truth about America. Penn Magazine, P-E-N-N, magazine.us. We thank you for taking the time to read Penn Magazine. Mike Politek, editor, Chuck Gregory, publisher.
And now we join in progress another episode of The Americans. The Americans is brought to us by Crisis Actors of the Homeland, Operation Mockingbird, Operation Northwoods, COINTELPRO, and by Kraft and Blackwater, bringing you Aurora, Tucson, Orlando, the Boston bombing, Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, Charlottesville, and so much more. The Americans dream of marshmallow clouds and lollipop lanes and TV towns, while the world wails, fists clenched, tears streaming. The Americans dream of rocket ships, fireworks, freedom, and alleluia, while they sleep on through the alarm, the house of fire. It's true that the newcomers to Washington, D.C. are different than ever before, but after all is said and done, they are Americans. The construction's underway for the wall around the Washington, D.C. Beltway to drain the swamp with an impressive culvert system and to separate the White House, the FBI, the CIA, the Pentagon, the Congress, and the Washington Press Corp from normal human beings. Scattered around the job site are the wooden boards to be tacked up all around the new wall with a message. Let me put it this way. While 9/11 was a U.S. deep state operation, probably subcontracted for execution to the Israelis, the entire Washington swamp has been, since 9/11, accomplished after the fact by helping to maintain the cover-up. If this is brought into light, then thousands of political careers are going to crash and burn into the scandal. Well, the nuts have really arrived in Pyeongchang, South Korea for the Winter Olympics. The child left behind and Skippy the construction worker and self-taught on YouTube demolition expert have been carrying boxes of secrets from the basement maintenance of secrets office out to the street on Pennsylvania Avenue, where they set the boxes open to the wind and let the papers fly wherever they may as they trudge back to the big White House to get more secrets. As Fred, the maintenance man of secrets, remains asleep, knocked out on the cement basement floor. Cosmo and Imelda Nutt are sitting on the balcony of their hotel room in South Korea, preparing to wave to the people during the opening ceremonies of the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. Meanwhile, the Bubbas have joined the Russian delegation, actually gotten right in line with the opening ceremony's entrance into the big stadium thing. The way it happened, well, they were sitting there in the RV when the announcer came to the R's. "Russia?" said the announcer. "Russia? Russia? Russia? Russia! Russia! Russia!" And Marsha Bubba, who was driving and fixing her hair in the rear view and not really listening, thought the announcer was saying, "Marsha, Marsha, Marsha." And she said, "Oh my God, sorry, sorry." And she swerved into line. And so there were the Bubbas marching into the big stadium thing in Russia spot. So they are actually Russia with the big Doritos flag waving from the antenna on the roof that they got free with 1,000 bags of Doritos that they turned in at the Pyeongchang Walmart. And as they enter the big stadium, people get up to cheer as the Russian Bubba delegation with the Doritos flag flying enters the big stadium thing. Bubba Bubba, Jennifer Bubba, and Justin Bubba are waving back, sitting in the folding chairs on the roof as Barbara Bubba and Brittany Bubba wave jarts out the windows at the crowd. In the meantime, Rusty the Patsy, Muhammad Ali the terrorist, Jews the limo driver, Slappy the house alien, Mama Pajama Jemima the MK Ultra trainer, Warren Beatty the secretary of getting things right, and Morgan Freeman the secretary of the War of the Worlds, with Red Devils and Sickles and Hammers and Stalin and Lenin and Boris and Natasha and the Kremlin freshly painted on their butts, are heading into Pyeongchang Square. They plan on pooping in Pyeongchang Square to make a national scandal that will go bad for Russia, probably. There's no press there, nobody there, except Mark, the most dangerous blogger on the planet, and Randall from Stevens Point. They march in just as they had practiced for months and months, circled the square and faced outward. Everyone pulls down their pants, they squat, their faces go red, and they begin to poop. "Jesus," said Mark, the most dangerous blogger on the planet, as he and Randall, who's about halfway invisible with his camel socks on, jump out of the way. "Hey, man, not cool," said Randall, as all the Americans made to look like Russians began showing their red butts like baboons in heat. Morgan Freeman, secretary of the Office of the War of the Worlds, tried to explain as his face went red. "No, no, look, we're poop riot. Poop riot. Don't you get it? Don't you get it? Do I have to spell it out for you? Just like the CIA and, you know, this is the same thing, only different. This is designed to, you know, in order to get it?" Cosmo and Imelda Nutt heard the announcer on their TV but did not see the massive crowds outside their balcony. The heads went back and forth, as the scene on the TV with the big crowd did not match the scene outside their balcony with nobody. They heard the Soviet Bubba Quidditch team announced. Cosmo came over to stand in front of the TV to wonder where the U.S. Quidditch team was. "Probably next," Cosmo muttered. And now, said the announcer, here comes the Russian bowling squad, which was actually the Bubbas. And the announcer, who had attended Bowling Green University on a Quidditch scholarship, so he knew a little something about bowling, he assumed that with the RV, this must be the bowling team. Cosmo waited and waited and waited, and there was no announcement of the American bowling squad. It's like Lennon said a melted nut from the balcony. You look for the person who will benefit, and, you know. I am the walrus, said Cosmo. You know, said Imelda, what I'm trying to say. I am the walrus, said Cosmo. Cosmo threw down the clicker, and he and Imelda stormed out of the hotel, caught an Uber, and said, take us to the nearest bowling supply company, fast. As the child left behind and Skippy the construction worker and self-taught on YouTube demolition expert shared a cigarette on the sidewalk and watched the wind lifting the secret pages out of the boxes and distributing them evenly around the block, Cosmo and Imelda Nutt strode into the big stadium thing, waving both hands over their heads and wearing brown and yellow stretchy shirts with two crossed bowling pins and Ali's House of Jihad, written on the back. Join us next week for the bobsled competition, Quidditch, bowling, and probably some other stuff. A tape deck, some Creedence tapes, and a briefcase. Lots of ins and outs, what have you.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Coming up in our next half hour, several more interviews, including Richard Flamer from Chiapas, Mexico. We thank you for being with us tonight. And we're also going to have Frank Cordero leading off the next half hour.
Chuck, you're involved in a political campaign. Tell me about that quick.
Well, a friend of mine is running for the city commission in Fort Lauderdale. His name is Tim Smith, and I've actually been making calls on his behalf. Tim is a real nice guy. He is honest. He listens to people, and he gets things done. And, well, you can tell he gets things done because he got me to make calls on his behalf, and I don't do that usually.
Is he running against, so he's the challenger to an incumbent?
Oh, no, it's a runoff. The seat was vacated, and these were the top two of five grand prime.
What's your district or whatever?
Thank you. RadioSlips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow, Monday, 6 to 8 p.m. EST, Studio B.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and Earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest on the show is Frank Cordero. Frank Cordero joins us each week from the Des Moines Catholic Worker in Des Moines, Iowa. Frank is a former Catholic priest. He has been a lifelong Catholic worker. He founded the Catholic Worker along with somebody else in Des Moines. He spent over 6 years in federal prison and county jail for fighting against the U.S. military machine. And Chuck visited with Frank earlier, and we're going to get to hear that conversation right about now.
Chuck.
Hello, Frank.
Hello. Hello, Chuck. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, we're here in Iowa. We weathered one major snow blizzard scene, and we have another one coming. So rolling snowstorms in the Midwest reporting in. I just snuck over to my house, the Berrigan House. We're currently serving our regular meal at the Dingman House. A low turnout. It's really strange. It's hard to figure out when they're going to show up or not. Like Tuesday was just jam packed. Just kind of a easy day. And then you called here, and I'm thinking like, oh my God, it's Thursday again, and Chuck's calling. So you caught me in a pretty much blank space. The first thing of business is to report that nothing to report with Jess and Ruby. That's still an ongoing story, and the grief continues to metastasize. To say that's really what it is you just kind of make it through the grief and try to figure out what it means. So. Doing that personally, the discipline of the Catholic worker is, which, you know, is like I've said before, you know, the whole idea is to make it easier to do good, as Peter Moran would say, where it's easier, a world where it's easier to do good. And serving a bowl of soup to the poor is a high-value activity in biblical sense. Yet most people don't have the time to do it. Me, I roll out of bed. I do it all the time. It's a really blessed place to be. In the world of the Gospels, you know, Jesus is all about
changing expectations in holy places. Like the temple doesn't matter anymore. But a leper on the road does. And you can touch them and heal them. That's really good stuff. So I'm trying to get into the discipline of the radical Jesus life. So having said all that, that's all good stuff. And really some interesting conversations are going on within the Catholic worker movement regarding Jesse Ruby's action vis-a-vis the Plowshares movement and the Catholic worker movement. And there's discussions going on all over the country. That's really good. And there's been one on racism that was brought up recently too. So within the clan of the Catholic worker, those two issues are coming to the fore and discussions are being had. And we're setting up for our 85th birthday anniversary party in Rochester, New York, the last weekend of July. That's going to be an interesting gathering. It's a national gathering of Catholic workers. So all of these things, I'm sure, will be discussed. And I've got it in my calendar. And that's not the only one that's going on. There's the 50th anniversary of the Catonsville Nine and the draft boards. And that's going to be taken on in Baltimore the first weekend of May. So I'm hoping to go to those two things. So my life is, seeing ahead at these things to remember. Jesus, just remember a great tradition. I've been contemplating these discussions and Catholic worker identity issues going on, it's the fact that we're even having a discussion about property destruction like Jess and Ruby's as to whether it's, the right way to do it, the wrong way to do it, but no one's condemning them or anything like that. I mean, I wish we'd have more support, but the fact that we're having this kind of discussion, there are no other groups in this country that are even having this discussion. There are no other faith groups, very few, that really are asking the real questions. I'm grateful that in a very dark country, in a state of Iowa, which is a functioning fascist Christian culture, I'm at least can see, have some sight in darkness. That's about the best a white guy can do out here. How you doing down there in Florida, Chuck?
Well, we're hanging in there down here. Nothing really to report. I must say our weather is a bit better than yours. But
yes, that's why we call you Florida.
Well, I don't envy you the weather, but I really admire your commitment, and I wish I could maybe get to one of those gatherings. I don't think I will this year, but that's pretty amazing. 50 years, Catonsville Nine, and was it 80 years anniversary?
85 years, 85. Catholic worker.
That
we're about 42 years into it, so like. We're like the second half, and there was another half before us. It's amazing.
Right, yeah.
All right, buddy. We'll talk about next week. Thank you.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, Frank.
God bless. Bye-bye.
God bless.
And now we hear from Matt, the world's most dangerous blogger. His parents have sent him out of their basement to the town square in Pingpong, South Korea, so he can do his live remote blogging, podcasting, tweeting, Instagramming, and Facebooking from the Winter Olympics, and they can back him up to Cheetos filling up their basement.
This is Matt, world's most dangerous blogger, coming to you live from the town square in Pingpong, South Korea. And remember, they don't want you to know that Cheetos dust and moon dust are both orange. Think about it. go to a park bench, listen to Supertramp, and just think about it for a while. Do it today. Modern propaganda techniques utilized by the corporate state to enforce anti-democratic and destructive policies routinely entail the manufacture and manipulation of news events to mold public opinion and, as Edward Bernays put it, engineer consent towards certain ends. The U.S. provocation of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and the Tonkin Gulf incident are obvious examples of such manufactured events. Similar techniques are apparent in the major political assassinations of the 1960s, where to this day the public is prompted to partake in the false reality that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole culprit in the murder of President John F. Kennedy, or that Sirhan Sirhan was responsible for the death of Senator Robert F. Kennedy. For 16 years, a new generation of Americans has been born into the 9/11 myth that has been used to create the American warfare police state. The corrupt Bush and Obama and now Trump regimes used 9/11 to kill, maim, dispossess, and displace millions of Muslims in seven countries, none of whom had anything whatsoever to do with 9/11. A generation of Americans has been born into continuous warfare while needs of citizens go unmet. According to the official story, on September 11, 2001, the vaunted national security state of the world's only superpower was defeated by a few young Saudi Arabians armed only with box cutters. If such a thing had actually happened, there would have been demands from the White House, from Congress, and from the media for an investigation. Officials would have been held accountable for their failures. Heads would have rolled. Instead, the White House resisted for 1 year the 9/11 family's demands for an investigation. Washington concluded that 9/11 was possible because America lacked a police state. And for the next 10 years, Osama bin Laden was the bogeyman that provided the excuse for Washington to kill countless numbers of Muslims. Then suddenly on May 2, 2011, Obama claimed that U.S. Navy SEALs had killed bin Laden in Pakistan. Eyewitnesses on the scene contradicted the White House story. Numerous obituaries of bin Laden's death in December 2001 went down the memory hole. And the SEAL team died a few weeks later in a mysterious helicopter crash in Afghanistan. The thousands of sailors on the aircraft carrier from which bin Laden was said to have been dumped into the Indian Ocean wrote home that no such burial took place. When it became clear that the White House had blocked an independent investigation of the only three steel skyscrapers in world history to collapse as a result of low-temperature office fires, it was apparent there was a cover-up. After 16 years, people at home and abroad find the government story even less believable. Millions of Muslims have paid for this lie with their lives, the destruction of their families, and with their dislocation. Most Americans remain comfortable with the fact that their government has destroyed in whole or part seven countries based on a lie that launched the drive for Washington's world empire.
The next guest of the show is Richard Flamer. Richard Flamer operates the Chiapas, Mexico Catholic Worker along with his wife, Araceli. Richard is a Vietnam veteran, former rare book dealer, former prison warden, former prisoner for peace. He was a Reuters war photographer in Central America for several years. He's a construction jack of all trades and now works for the poorest of the poor in the mountains of Mexico. The history of the Chiapas Project starts with Richard Flamer and his disillusionment after his time in Vietnam with the U.S. Army. The need to atone combined with intellectual pride sent Richard Flamer along a path of violence, arrogance, and academia. Heading to Central America during the 1980s, Flamer discovered a theology of liberation. He eventually converted to Catholicism after having witnessed the martyrdom of lay and frock followers of the Catholic Church, within which he could find faith and hope. After years of photographically documenting the stark realities of war and poverty in Central America and Southern Mexico, he returned to the Midwest. There, Flamer lived and worked in the Catholic worker community, helping with carpentry and construction. He returned to Mexico to start the Chiapas Project in San Cristobal de las Casas. Perry worked with Bishop Samuel Ruiz and various clergy to start a community center. The following 7 years were spent supporting and building the community center, which includes a daycare center, a modest kitchen, and classrooms for adult literacy, sewing, and carpentry. And now, Richard Flamer from Chiapas, Mexico.
Okay. Balthazar was a drunk. He drank for days, ran out of money, sobered up, and worked for 2 or 3 weeks. His working days were good days in manual labor for his neighbors and family. With the earthquake of September the 8th of 2016 in East Altepec and Juchitán, Oaxaca, workers were in great demand. Balta sobered up to help his friends and family. He worked 10 hours a day at 74 years old. He hauled scrap. He broke up concrete with a sledgehammer. He used a wheelbarrow to haul rubble. On my frequent trips from San Cristobal to East Altepec, a 500-mile round trip, I thought often of Balta and the other relatives of my wife. Here in San Cristobal, I collected money and ordered doors and windows from a local welder. I built furniture and ordered other tables, chairs, bed frames, closets, etc. from my carpenter friends. In the 6 trips I've made since the quake, Araceli and I, with the help of people like Balta, have managed to house 5 families by completing 2 houses, which had been started prior to the quake, but lacked doors, windows, and furniture. 2 of the other families moved into metal sheds put up by the Mennonites of Chihuahua. With those 2 families in temporary housing, we started 2 more concrete block houses, which should be habitable by mid-February. In the house that Araceli inherited, 1 brick wall suffered damage. That wall was replaced and we moved in a widow with the 3 children. In the house of Araceli's parents, we got the damaged section raised and new walls erected with only the roof to finish. On the street where dwelt 12 families with Araceli's parents included, the inhabitants are generally old, with their children grown and gone to the cities to form their own families. On our first trip, 2 days after the quake, Araceli phoned and got medical information from the 12 families. Most of the medicines were for blood pressure, diabetes, blood thinners, etc. With $1,000, we bought medicine sufficient for 3 months of maintenance. The 2 pharmacies in the village have been destroyed, along with 700 of the 1,200 houses. The nearest pharmacy was 30 miles away. And of course, few people have vehicles. My faith in my friends and cohorts was restored when I started making phone calls and sending emails. In the first 30 days after the quake, some $6,000 in pesos and dollars flowed into my account. The first monies went towards immediate needs of tools, medicine, fresh food, and blankets. The second trip was fresh fruit and vegetables, money to pay for labor, tarps, tools, and lumber. Assessing the needs of the 18 structures on the street, I started compiling a list of what was necessary to get the families out from under the tarps and into stable structures. On my return to San Cristobal, I ordered doors and windows to complete the 2 houses mentioned above. For the third visit, were some volunteers and I got the windows mounted for the families to move in. The 4th and 5th visits were much like the 3rd, with more doors and windows for the new rising structures. Labor was a continuing problem. The young people were all off working on government projects where the daily pay was better. The bridges, schools, and municipal buildings had all been badly damaged. So us old guys worked slower, but steadily moving rubble, digging footings, bending rebar for columns, etc. The youngest member of our crew was 66 years old. The materials were largely covered by government debit cards. The labor was supposed to be covered by a second debit card for cash, but 2 weeks after the cards were issued, the cash was emptied out by hackers. Only 6 of the families got out half of the cash while the other six families got nothing. From my generous friends, I was able to provide cash payments on all the trips, usually in the amount of 5,000 to 6,000 pesos, $200 to $300. Additionally, I paid for the work at the home of Araceli's parents, 10,000 pesos or $500, plus the work at Araceli's little inherited house, another 15,000 pesos, to repair one wall and part of a roof for the widow and her children. Something in my nature has to add to the sins of my compatriots. That is, I have to think about the sins and the joys in this extended emergency. I try to balance the acts of generosity with both spirit and goods, along with the venial acts of malice. A local diocesan priest has gathered food, clothing, diapers, and medicine for not only his local parishioners, but unlike the local evangelical pastors who only gave away goods to their own church members, he has extended the giving to all around the town, even borrowing trucks to transport the goods to neighboring villages and rural areas. The priest has recruited his altar boys and girls, a local flock of sisters, and a few old souls to organize and distribute the emergency food and supplies. All of the above, while the mayor or alcalde of nearby Huchitan has been hoarding material since the first days of their arrival. In her house, in a nearby municipal warehouse, she began collecting the tarps, tents, medicine, tinned foods, etc. At one point, she even had the police under her control, intercepting the private vehicles and trucks from various churches, directing the vehicles to unload at the warehouse. She claims the goods will be distributed at a later date. Most of the local citizens believe she's holding the materials for the upcoming election campaign to be distributed by her political party for the benefit of her political cronies. The army stepped in by the second week and took over all the distribution of materials. Along with the distribution, the medical teams of the military started going house to house, taking care of minor injuries, transporting the badly injured to the nearby military base hospital, since the three local clinics and one small hospital had been badly damaged. Squads of soldiers brought in heavy equipment, started clearing the rubble in both public and private sites. Of the 700 houses damaged beyond repair, 600 sites were cleared. The soldiers, meanwhile, slept in tents, brought in field kitchens, and fed the citizens along with the troops. In their own base camp, I reached the fact 60 of the apartments for married personnel were damaged, forcing the families into tents in the base gymnasium. The press, the media were everywhere. The emphasis, of course, was on the good deeds of the citizens. Reports came from northern Mexico of the collecting of food and water. From the U.S. came a plane load of emergency supplies from the Catholic Church. Nothing, by the way, from the government of Donald Trump. Not even a phone call to President Peña Nieto. From Cuba came 30 doctors, 30 nurses, and a portable equipment clinic the Cubans immediately set up with tents supplied by China, a large field clinic. Not mentioned in the news was the first group of Mennonites from Chihuahua with two trucks, wood trailers, tools, and materials. The group set up middle sheds designed as cottages with a single door and two windows. Units were assembled in 4 hours and were mostly given for widows and the old. After a week, the first group left Ixtlahuac, while a second group, also from Chihuahua, came with a tractor trailer full of unassembled huts, along with four separate crews of workers. After three further weeks, a total of 90 small houses were assembled. Some for permanent use for the inhabitants building concrete floors, while the remainder were used as a temporary housing to escape the constant winds while they waited to construct their proper homes. Only the leftist journal, La Jornada, covered the Cubans and the Mennonites. Balthazar worked with me and the family ran a selling on four of my trucks. Though old, skinny, and loath to bathe, he was a great worker. I was told to hold off paying him his daily wage at the urging of his family until the work was finished. I bought him cigarettes and ate with the family. On my last trip, we had a small celebration, great food, and I paid him. I last saw him as he walked off to his favorite cantina. The next morning, his body was found in the riverbed, where it appeared he stumbled, fell, hit his head on a nearby rock, and drowned. I will miss him and pray for his soul. In further news, I'm heading off to the U.S. on Saturday to pick up a truck, and we'll probably be spending time in Milwaukee and back down to Omaha and Des Moines, mostly gathering tools and trying to raise some money to finish up some more houses down there in earthquake country. Should be fun. And you, how's life in Florida?
Well, life is pretty good here. I don't have any real complaints. We're having nice weather. We haven't had any major disasters, and life goes on.
Sounds like fun to me. Chuck, I'll call you next month, or have you call me in. We'll go from there. How'd you like this one?
I like this very much. Thank you very much. Wow.
I'm planning on putting a couple of photos with the text, and I'll send them off to you when I get a chance, you and Michael.
That sounds good. I'm trying to put more stuff up on the website like that. And, you know, if you send it to me, that'll give me that much more reason to get to work.
Okay, Chuck. I'll talk to you next month, probably from either Omaha or Des Moines or San Antonio.
Okay, sounds good. And
okay, hey,
be safe.
Okay. Yeah.
Bye. I'm always so happy to talk to Richard Flamer and to listen to his stories of life in Mexico. We're so lucky to have him every month.
Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Wadia will remain a dictatorship.
Or be quiet.
Why are you guys so anti-dictators? Imagine if America was a dictatorship.
You could let 1% of the people have all the nation's wealth.
You could help your rich friends get richer by cutting their taxes and bailing them out when they gamble and lose. You could ignore the needs of the poor for healthcare and education. Your media would appear free, but would secretly be controlled by one person and his family. You could wiretap phones. You could torture foreign prisoners. You could have rigged elections. You could lie about why you go to war. You could fill your prisons with one particular racial group, and no one would complain. You could use the media to scare the people into supporting policies that are against their interests.
Tune in Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for Liberation Nation with Deacon John, where America comes to hear the truth.
I know this is hard for you Americans to imagine, but please try.
Anti-aircraft gun pointed to action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning.
We are far stronger than we were 10 weeks ago.
Hotel quarters, all hands at your battle stations.
Be nervous, count your toes. I'll do the mastermind around here.
You who have not seen it do not know what hell looks like from the top.
Check it out every Tuesday and Saturday on Revolution Radio. It's a double dose of the internationally recognized renegade military historian, Douglas Dietrich.
You'll stay right where you are until I tell you to move out.
Yeah, that's right. Tuesdays from 10 to midnight Eastern Time. Join Douglas Dietrich as he exposes the truth in hidden history on his show Critical Omissions. And then our human weapon of mass destruction is back once again to take your calls on Saturday night firing lines. Both from 10 to 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Only on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest of the show is Jim Fetzer, a former Marine Corps officer. Dr. James Fetzer is McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He has conducted extensive research into the assassination of JFK, the events of 9/11, the plane crash that killed Senator Paul Wellstone, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, and many more. And now, Dr. Jim Fetzer in Madison, Wisconsin.
Mike, Chuck, great to be with you today. Some updates about Las Vegas. The coroner's office has been on lockdown, but why? If you have followed the research published on my blog at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, you'll understand that Mona Alexis Presley has been investigating the obituaries and found that they are for people who died in different states or on different dates or from different causes of death. This was so embarrassing that the causes of death were listed for 58 killed in Las Vegas shooting, but it was just a list. It didn't have any legal significance so far as I can tell. And it's a form of deception taking place here. Ramona has also discovered the crime map for the 1 square mile area around the concert from 8 p.m. on the first to 8 p.m. on the second. And the sum total of events were other disturbance, assault and battery, other disturbance, assault and battery, burglary, stolen motor vehicle, burglary, malicious destruction, other disturbance, other disturbance, recovered motor vehicle, other disturbance, robbery. During that entire 24-hour period, there was not a single shooting reported, much less a mass shooting of 58 people and more than 500 injured. This appears to be completely and totally fraudulent. We also have the report that Paddock had 7 different cell phones, which suggests the reason he had 23 weapons in his room was because it was a showroom. He was showcasing the weapons he had available. If a potential buyer wanted to test fire one or another, then he'd arrange for that to be done elsewhere, which at least begins to make sense of why he had this vast array of weapons. The media, however, is completely ignoring the new FBI information suggesting Paddock was a Vegas arms dealer. Not only that, but the Mandalay Bay is now acknowledging that its staff visited Paddock's room 10 times before the shooting and noticed nothing. I mean, get that. 3 months after the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history, yet another crucial change in the narrative has occurred as MGM Resorts International is now claiming that the hotel staff at Mandalay Bay had at least 10 interactions with suspect Stephen Paddock in the days before the shooting. At least 2 of those interactions occurred on October 1st, the day that Paddock was alleged to have killed 58 people and injured more than 500 by launching a shooting spree out of his hotel window on the 32nd floor. A spokesperson for MGM told the Las Vegas Review-Journal that the interactions on that fatal day consist of room service delivery and a visit from housekeeping where they notice nothing out of the ordinary. Now, I must say Intel Hub has been coming into its own lately after having blown it over Hooters, where they mistakenly thought there were 17 ambulances pulled up in front of Hooters, and therefore there had to have been a mini massacre. When their own video footage show inside Hooters were a whole lot of bored crisis actors, each with their own sheet, waiting their turn to be taken out as another victim. Well, they're making amends by noticing that Paddock had ears that smoothly attached to his head, but that the figure lying dead in the suite had curled earlobes, not smooth attaching, suggesting this is not Stephen Paddock. Not only that, but the doctor autopsied does not appear to be Stephen Paddock either, the official Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department report reveals, because he was 73 inches tall at 6'1". But we have an Alaska sport fishing trapping hunting license that shows him to be 6'4". I think this looks very much like a complete scam. We don't even have the right body. Exclusive. Laura Loomer, who's published quite a lot of good stuff about Las Vegas, Officials claim only half of Vegas shooting victims received full autopsies. That's completely absurd. According to two sources within the Clark County Coroner's Office, only half of the 58 victims who were killed on October 1st, 2017, received a standard autopsy. The officials, whose identities and professional background have been independently verified and kept anonymous to protect their jobs, both emphasize their dismay over the fact that some of the victims did not receive fair treatment. Now, look how grossly discrepant this report is with if the shooting scenario had actually been authentic. I commented about it as follows. One more proof that the whole Las Vegas massacre was an elaborate fraud. Laura has been doing exceptional work where Intel Hub has reported that the body seen in the crime scene photo had different ears than Paddock, and that he had a shot to the chest as well as a shot to the head, and that the body subjected to autopsy was only 6'1" when Paddock was 6'4" tall. For those who care about the truth, it was a movie with a pre-recorded soundtrack and coordinated special visual effects where the crowd had been seated with crisis actors. There were simulated shots from the fourth floor in the middle of the hotel and a higher floor. The fourth floor was simulating machine gun light bursts, the higher floor, three-shot light bursts. And a man in the crowd turning and firing, we can see the flash of his muzzle, but no impact of shots because he was using blanks. The three closest hospitals reported no gunshot victims, and the obituaries turned out to have been for persons who died in different states or on different dates or from different causes of death. For a comprehensive overview of how it was done and why, check out the Brian Ruhe Show, R-U-H-E, Las Vegas Update with Jim Fetzer. Now, the Clark County coroner has disregarded a court order to unseal the October 1st victim autopsy reports in hiding evidence. It's true what they say, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Intel Hub, Clark County coroner John Fudenberg has failed to turn over the 1 October victim's autopsy reports and Stephen Paddock's autopsy report against what a judge ruled in court on Tuesday. Not only are the coroner's actions inexcusable, it's blatantly obvious that a cover-up is and has been underway. Remember, it was already proven in a 28 January Intel Hub report titled Body Autopsy by Doctor Likely Not Stephen Paddock's official Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department report reveals that something was drastically wrong. Not to mention the fact that the body pictured in the crime scene photos was cremated on 21 December. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And now we have the further development that the judge, being highly dissatisfied with this turn of events, has directed that all documents from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department's investigation of 1 October must be released within 30 days. I certainly saw this coming. It was obvious to me that the judge was not going to allow the coroner to sandbag. Judge rules that all documents from Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department's investigation of 1 October must be released within 30 days. The documents include all video evidence and body camera footage. This ruling excludes any information or video footage that specifically identifies the victims or gives out their personal information. The whole thing's falling apart, and well, it should, because nobody died in Las Vegas. It was a movie, and it looks to me as though the truth is now going to come out, and that this judge is going to be extremely unhappy with the coroner for evading his order and directive. And I predict As soon as we have all the documents and records, it will be obvious that the whole thing was an elaborate scam, that nobody died in Las Vegas, and that the coroner winds up being at the center of the whole elaborate charade. This is Jim Fetzer thanking Mike and Chuck for featuring me today. More on the Las Vegas shooting as we proceed.
And now, Milk Duds Are Forever, a review of The Post with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep by Steven Spielberg, by New American Dream movie reviewer Sancho Panza. As Robert Crowley, CIA agent, says, I can guarantee that the press will either keep very, very quiet about you or will make a fool out of you. We still do control the press, and if we say to trash an enemy, they will do it. We control most of the major publishers, or if we don't, they would never dare to put out anything that would get us upset. Hell, we have our man right there in the New York Times, and they jump through the hoops, believe me. The Times is in our pocket, absolutely. One thing the CIA's Frank Wisner did was to build up a very cooperative media, and that includes book publishers. Even if some big publishing house printed a sensitive book, it would never see the light of day. Why? Because our people would block it. It's that simple. They would ruin you as they have ruined many other authors who have gone before you for daring to speak ill of them. Can you imagine the New York Times reviewing it? I think not. I think not ever. One phone call from us and into the wastebasket with any kind of commentary, good or bad. The blanket of silence would descend upon you, believe me. Silly idealists somehow believe we have a free press here, but it is as tightly controlled as it is in Russia or it was in Hitler's Germany. Milk Duds Are Forever, a review of The Post by New American Dream movie reviewer Sancho Panza. Our next guest of the evening is Thomas Wertmann. Thomas Wertmann is the Ohio State Director of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. He lives in the Cleveland suburbs and is the dean of a university in Northeast Ohio. Now we're going to try and contact Thomas Wirt in Cleveland.
Hello.
Hello, Thomas. Hello? It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show. You're on the air.
Great. Well, what I want to do tonight is a couple things we have time. One is kind of go a little bit more into the Pentagon announcement that they made back in December and give a little more clarity on some of the things I found out. And second thing is about SpaceX, their launch, if we have time. Well, on the Pentagon discussion I had back in December, one of the things I was getting into is some of the videos that you're seeing released on the internet. And when the videos came out, I'm like, okay, well, here's these videos that show this object. And you have to watch the websites you get it from, because one of the websites was describing these incredible, unreal motions. And I'm watching a video, and it looks like the object is going, it's either stationary or directly ahead of the aircraft, so it wasn't making outlandish movements. But one of the other videos that came out in December did show an object in front of a craft making a turn. Well, I started pursuing that, and to kind of give a little background on the story again, what happened was, is back in November of 2004, the military was conducting some exercises off the coast of San Diego, about 70 miles out. And they'd been tracking some unusual objects over a period of about a week to 2 weeks. And they didn't get into a whole lot of detail at that time, but they said they were just tracking unusual objects. Well, this video came out that it had the voices of pilots evidently tracking an object in front of them. And they showed that this object was in front, it was making a turn, and the pilots were banking, trying to stay up with it. Well, one of the members of used to be MUFON, Robert Powell, who's in science area out there, he was doing a lot of investigation on it. So I researched what he found. I also dug a lot deeper on those videos. And some of the things came out that kind of cleared some things up. One is there's a couple different flights at that time. One is what was happening is the USS Princeton, which was a guided missile cruiser, was tracking objects about 70 miles off the coast of San Diego. And what they did is they had some Marine fighters were in the region. So they contacted the Marine fighters and sent them to that area to kind of investigate. Now, when they sent them out, one of the things that kind of caught one of the pilots off guard when he talked to him later on, is they asked him if he had ordnance on board, meaning, are you armed? Now, why would they ask if you're armed unless maybe they're thinking maybe it's somebody out running drugs or something up along the coast? But it's kind of an unusual statement to ask. Well, they also contacted a radar plane, which is an E-2 Hawkeye. The radar plane also tried to track the objects about 70 miles off of San Diego, and they were barely able to pick up any target whatsoever. But the Princeton, which has some of our best radar systems on, was able to track it. So they took control, guided the pilots out to the location. And when the pilots got there, the pilot, the one in charge, did not see the actual object itself, but what he saw, not at its altitude, but he saw a disturbance on the top of the water. Now, these objects were noted over the period of time, going anywhere from like 80,000 feet down to sea level. So he saw a disturbance on the water that looked maybe about 50 feet in diameter, and he watched, observed it, and he told him he wasn't tracking anything on his radar himself personally, and they told him to break off. Well, instead of breaking off, he said, well, since I'm here in the air, I might as well make one pass. He made a swoop, and by the time he got down maybe about 10,000 feet above the water, the water kind of, in this case, kind of like flattened out and the disturbance was gone. So he broke off and left the area. And a second flight of jets came in, and this is also guided by the Princeton, and they were naval jets. When they came in, they were guided to the region. They picked up nothing on radar, and also the first flight picked up nothing on their own radar. And all of a sudden, when they get at the area, Princeton said, you just merged with the object, meaning you're at the same location. Well, they had nothing on their radar. They saw nothing initially visually. But then one of the pilots noticed, again, at a much lower altitude, because what he did is he started dropping down. He left one jet up at 20,000 feet. He dropped down to roughly about 10,000 feet. He saw an object down below, which he called, let's say, it looked like a tic-tac. So he started kind of going down to kind of intercept it. Well, the object started moving and even appeared to almost turn and point towards him, almost like it noticed him, was observing him. So this object is moving, starts banking, and he tries doing a bank, and this is similar to what you see in the video. Well, he tries to turn, and this object has a higher capability than he does to make a tighter turning radius, and all of a sudden he said the object disappeared at multi-Mach speed. The Princeton, at that point, lost it on their radar. He lost it visually. And after a few seconds, the Princeton radioed him back saying, oh, it's back up at its initial altitude. We tracked that, which is roughly about 20,000 feet. So, I mean, here he was banking this object, trying to stay with it. Next thing you know, it made a tighter turn than he could, disappeared at multi-Mach speed, now had a position up above him at 20,000 feet. So in the pilot's mind, it had way higher capability. Now, the pilot that you see on the internet, if you check out some of the videos, his name is Favor, he was the one who was interviewed. And a lot of the shows are showing the video, which is posted on the internet along with him. But while I'm watching it, both planes were asked if they had infrared radar, and both did not have infrared radar. The videos that they're showing on the internet are done with infrared. Well, what was leading me to believe is potentially that was a later flight that also observed the same objects. When he was describing his terms, they also appeared to be like a mirror image of what was being seen in the videos. It was almost exactly opposite. Well, from what I'm finding out, the video, as I thought, was not from him. It's kind of misleading. And skeptics out there may kind of love that because it kind of debunks the whole story. But it still doesn't explain what they were tracking out there. Was this military? Was it from someplace? We don't know. So I'm trying to get more clarity now on that side. But it appears that the video we're seeing is taken from a later flight that went out around that same region. Because when he got back, and he was also, by the way, asked if he had ordnance on board, when he got back to the carrier, he kind of prompted the next crew that was going out on what had been happening. And it's very likely they may have been some of the ones taking the videos. But supposedly, the group which put the videos on the internet, which is To the Stars Academy by Tom DeLonge, they're saying they also have more videos that they're going to be releasing shortly that go back to the same thing. But something definitely happened unusual out there. But the military is not saying it was theirs, and we don't know what it was. When I looked at the area also, doing some research, I found that that is an area for military exercises. Coincidentally, between 80,000 feet and sea level, and that's where the area objects were being tracked at. When the story also came out, one of the things I remembered is talking to an individual who came to one of our local meetings of the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. Our group has bi-monthly meetings. There's an individual who showed up that one evening in a meeting. When he walked in, he had the appearance of almost like a Tom Cruise. Every hair in place, kind of reminded the guy in Top Gun. We sat down at the meeting of a 9-year-old son, and they listened the whole meeting. He never said a word, never kind of offered anything up. And I'm like, that guy's got something to say. And I'm waiting to see what he does after the meeting. Well, after the meeting, everybody left, and he stayed with his son. And he came up to me and says, I was a career Navy man. And he looked to be about 40 years old, so he probably put in 20 years and got out. And he goes, when I was in the military, we were over in Desert Storm. And he started describing things on, he said he was stationed on the carrier. He said, we were seeing objects from the ship that they would scramble jets to intercept. When they would go out to intercept the objects, they said the pilots would get to the region they're at. They would try to intercept them, almost do like motions like this pilot described off of San Diego of diving down to the object, trying to intercept it, making turns that they couldn't stay up with the object. And he was describing the exact same motions from their pilots. He said, our pilots on our carriers were intercepting them. They would try to take and stay up with these objects, and they couldn't stay up with them because they could turn at much faster turning radius. They could accelerate at much higher speeds. And it got, he said, it got to the point that the kind of scuttlebutt he was getting is that the pilots were refusing to even pursue these things anymore. They'd been doing it so much, and the objects were just playing games with them. And it's like, this is not recent. This is going back, you know, back to Desert Storm. So these objects seen in 2004 is not the first time. It's been happening for quite some time out there. And the question is, what are they? Are they ours? Are they somebody else's? But it appears as they must have a much higher technology than what we've got. So I'm looking for more things on this story to come out. Now, something else, on a different note, kind of a humorous note. I don't know if your listeners out there have been watching Elon Musk. He's listed as being, I think, like 21st richest man in the world. No, 51st, worth about $21 billion. He had PayPal. Now he's big thing right now with SpaceX. Well, a couple days ago, they launched one of the most powerful rockets in the world. Now, we think back years ago when we went to the moon, you had the Saturn V. These things were tremendously powerful on there. The space shuttle had a tremendous amount of power out there. I remember talking to the engineers down at NASA, and they said when they launched the shuttles, if you were on the island where the shuttle was at, when it launched, you're probably going to be death, if not injured seriously or fatally because of the shock wave and the sound waves coming from that Saturn is, or I mean, the shuttle as it took off.
Oh,
that's
time, Thomas. Thank you so much.
That's right. Next month.
Okay.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message. Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow, Monday, 6 to 8 p.m. EST, Studio B.
Decentralization and bank annihilation. Bitcoin, Litecoin, MyCoin, YourCoin, blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern Studio A.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
We talk a lot on this show about Jessica Resnicek, or we refer to her many times during our visits with Frank Cordero in Des Moines. We now recall what was occurring 2 years ago at this time. And so now, a letter from the Sarpy County Jail.
Northrop Grumman specializes in murder, by Jessica Resnicek. From Sarpy County Jail, Papillion, Nebraska. February 29, 2016. This article has been done a million times, I suppose. I'm sitting here in Sarpy County because it just needs to continue being written. You can take out Northrop Grumman and fill in the blank with any defense contractor which suits you. Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Booz Allen Hamilton, Raytheon, General Dynamics, BAE Systems, and on and on. Let's begin with a basic truth. Northrop Grumman specializes in murder. Northrop Grumman is not a human being. It is an industry. It does not feel joy or sorrow. It has no sense of purpose beyond its business model. It does not breathe, laugh, smile, or bleed because Northrop Grumman is not alive. Northrop Grumman does not grow. It merely expands and collapses under the weight of its profit margins. Its success is defined by sales reports. Its existence is dependent upon these sales, which are in turn determined by the demands of its industry. And Northrop Grumman's industry makes today's wars possible. It thrives on climates of fear, chaos, despair, destruction, and deceit. And we, the American people, have unknowingly become Northrop Grumman's number one client, awarding it $55 billion taxpayer dollars in its most recent contract with the U.S. government signed last October. In its 2014 annual report, Northrop Grumman attributes 85% of its total sales to its primary client, the U.S. government. The report states that we depend heavily on a single customer, the U.S. government, for a substantial portion of our business. Changes in this customer's priorities and spending could have a material adverse effect on our financial position. Basically, Northrop Grumman needs our tax dollars in order to continue feeding its war industry. therefore needs Congress to pass laws which, stated simply, are favorable to murder. But Northrop Grumman continually underestimates the voice of the American people and undervalues the kindness in our hearts which guides us. Left on our own, Americans repeatedly choose life, beauty, and peace over war, death, and destruction. For this reason, Northrop Grumman has increasingly become more deceptive in its business tactics. Bottom line, if the American public wanted war, Northrop Grumman would not be tiptoeing in the shadows, hiding behind its lies. If the American people wanted to support the war industry, Northrop Grumman would be a household name. Plain and simple, the American people are being lied to on many levels, and the lying needs to stop. No industry funded by public money for public projects should be allowed to pay its CIO $25 million a year while the American people and their institutions are suffering from lack of good health care, safe public drinking water and food, clean air, free education, and yes, as I am currently incarcerated, I must add adequate legal counsel for all underprivileged. Northrop Grumman specializes in murder. Let's stop funding murder and start funding communities of life. Let's make the decision now to commit to fund industries that have a business plan that works for peace and not war. Jessica Resnicek, Sarpy County Jail, F1 Mod, Cell SB. Jessica Resnicek was awaiting trial for having smashed with a sledgehammer the front door and window of the Northrop Grumman headquarters in Bellevue, Nebraska, on December 27th. Well, it's been another long week in Moon Rock Lake, Ohio, my hometown at the end of the empire. It was, for me, the world of Dick and Jane, the world that every child should inhabit, a world with yellow brick roads, the security of parental love, full stomachs, and overflowing hearts filled with warm feelings. Bob Keesham, Captain Kangaroo, forward to the world of Dick and Jane. The American dream has dangled before our eyes for over 200 years. The American dream is the goal that we Americans hold on to when everything else is gone. The American dream is our ideal. Too bad, it's just a dream. The Americans dream of marshmallow clouds and lollipop lanes and TV towns. While the world wails, fists clenched, eyes blazing, tears streaming. The Americans dream of rocket ships, fireworks, freedom, and alleluia. While they sleep on through the alarm, the house afire. We pick up our story after Michael M., staff member at Sun God Group Home, has sped off on his moped to tell the people at the workshop that there's a sit-down strike taking place in the Sun God driveway and they will be a little late. On his way, he swerved to miss a little girl, jumped the curb, and rammed his blue flake helmet into a war memorial for World War II at the city park, breaking the war memorial. And now the National Guard and police have stormed the park and taken Michael M. away in a National Guard helicopter. Michael M. was in prison for having rammed World War II with a blue flake helmet. But he loves Homeland. All he really wants to do is get free so he can get registered for the Home Helper Show drawing and make his wife proud and his children happy. He escaped prison when another prisoner gave up his own gold teeth to the guards in exchange for M's release. M then arrived at the home of the family of the little girl he almost killed with his moped, and the father asked M for a favor in return for helping him to get registered for the Home Helper Show drawing. We pick up our story after the parade. After the parade, M still sits in the cage in the elevator machine shop even after the big red-haired man has promised to let him go. M sat on the wagon floor of the cage of the Homeland Elevator Company float inside the elevator maintenance shop. He held his head in his hands, trying to scratch his back on the wooden wagon flooring. The outside door opened. M saw a brief, bright square of light. "When do I get out of here?" he asked, while the big red-haired man was still across the room. "Hey, I'm headed down to vote," the man called. "Get you anything?" "You said you would get me registered." "Oh, yeah. There's time for that. Did you see the fireworks last night?" "No, I guess you didn't. Pretty awesome." "I heard it," said M. "Could you get me a hamburger? Fries?" The man shot both pointer fingers at M. M stood to say, "And a strawberry malt?" "Listen, M, as soon as we do a couple more parades, some county fairs, we'll get you all signed up. How about that?" The man strolled toward the door with his head down, hands in his pockets. Sure. "Can you ask for extra ketchup, please?" M sat down in the middle of the wagon. He leaned back on his hands, stretched his legs out. The door opened and slammed shut. The polling places at the East Side churches and the community center did a steady business throughout the morning. Some citizens had set up the West Side polling station and sharpened the pencil. Voters had begun to take their turn, tearing off a square, dropping their votes into the receptacle. M waited until afternoon in the sauna of the metal elevator machine shed. He realized the big red-haired man had forgotten his malt. He tried fitting his head between the bars, tried eating the straw. He heard scattered fireworks still going off around town. "We are so free," M said out loud to himself. "That our flag was still there," he sang. M lay on his back, listening to the pigeons. The door squeaked open and whammed shut. M thought, "It's about time." "Hey," the little girl squeaked. M sat up. "Hey." "Just a minute," she said. She put a foot on one of the big tires and worked hard and grunted and gripped the top of the wagon. "Careful," said M. The girl fought to pull herself up by the edge. She got her face above the floor, just hanging on by her fingertips. She gripped the $10 bill in her teeth. She nodded with her chin to suggest that M take the money. Then she let herself down and backed up to be able to see M. She pointed to a pile of clothes she'd placed by the wagon. Without warning, she wound up and fired a ring of keys at M, striking him square in the stomach. "It's one of them," she said. "There wasn't going to be any ice cream. I talked to my cousin Rosie. You need to get out of here. This is so lame." She held out her arms to encompass everything. The girl pivoted on the toe of her black patent leather shoe and headed for the door. M appeared at the door of the elevator maintenance building, peering through a crack out at the town. Cars moving slowly down Main Street. Kids on bikes. A Mexican couple walking, holding pinky fingers. Grind Zero, that's where he was, where it all started. When the elevator was attacked by midget aliens flying remote control airplanes, they'd made it explode and fall down, so Dick had no choice but to bomb the West Side and ban public speaking and private conversations. "I love this land," said M to himself out loud. He wore his old clothes, the ones given to him that night the guard let him go. M needed to get registered for the Homeland segment of the Home Helper show, so he could get his kitchen remodeled, an addition put on, the bathroom made larger, and a pool with clear water and bubbles. He needed to get to his house and talk to his wife. He pushed open the door all the way. one small step for man, a seemingly larger step for man, he mumbled. M walked down Main Street, his head held high, back straight, anticipating direct eye contact. He noticed the new stop, drop, and roll billboard atop the bakery. He did not wish to be recaptured by the elevator manager. He'd heard him talking about the circus, but he felt he could outrun the big red-haired man in an open field. At the end of the day, what he really needed was to get on with his life. Turn the next page. He stopped to look in the window of Bradley's clothing store to admire the new skins, light brown reversible jackets. The sign next to the display said, "Look for the illegal label, 100% Mexican, made in Arizona." M shook his head. He'd never be able to afford one of those. Didn't even have a job. M headed down the street past the bakery, the community center, the library, the bookstore. Saw his own face on some of the "Be Afraid" signs along the sidewalk. Resolved to turn his life around, to make his family proud of him. Maybe he could be a coach, a youth minister, a scout leader. He marched straight toward his own little house, turning right on Liberty Avenue on two blocks, left at Freedom. A block from his home, M could smell the familiar apple pies sitting in the kitchen windows of the houses. Each home was shiny white with a sun god flag snapping from the front porch. Plastic children's toys in primary colors littered the front lawns of most of the residences. Each lawn spread full and emerald. Fathers in white t-shirts and dress slacks sipped Freedom Fizz, brought outside to them by smiling wives in black high heels sporting crisp red and white fluffy dresses. "I love this town," said M to himself. He smiled and waved to his neighbors, watching him suspiciously. M saw his next-door buddy and walked over to visit with him as he knelt on his lawn, reading his Bible and shining his grass with a chamois. "Hey!" M raised his hand. Without speaking, staring M in the eyes, the man pointed a garden hose at M. He stuck his thumb in the stream and shot it into M's eyes. M clamped his eyes, put up his hands, turned around and walked away. M headed down the sidewalk toward his house. The neighbor's two little children ran up behind him. M turned and smiled. He bent down to say hello to the tiny boy and girl. They drew back, each fired an egg at M, hitting him in the face and shoulder. They turned and ran away across the grass to their house, churning their little legs and pumping their chubby arms and fists as if the devil was right behind. M stood and watched him as he wiped his face and clothes. He turned again toward his house, fought against tears when he saw his wife's plucky little red and yellow and white chrysanthemums in the front plot under the window. The white house needed painting. So did the garage. Shingle bits littered the weedy flower beds. The driveway was cracked. The gutters still held last fall's leaves. M walked to the side door back by the garage and tried it. He came around to the front door, locked as well. Leaned around over the front railing. You look in the window and saw the house was dark, except for the bathroom light. A bear and a baby doll with just her top on were on the floor next to some toy cups and dishes. Also scattered around were books, green and orange sippy cups, a spoon half full of peanut butter, Care Bears tapes, and Finding Nemo. M straightened up, put his hands on his hips, put his head down to think. Maybe she was out voting. He could wait, then call to get registered or however you do it. M turned around, sat down on the front cement porch steps. He reached for a concrete chip and tossed it at the open garbage can his wife had set out for pickup. "It's good," he said, made crowd noise by putting his hand over his mouth and breathing hard. and picked eggshell off his shirt, looked up. On his front sidewalk stood a line of his neighbors. They stared hard with hands on hips. One of the men held a cell phone to his ear. "He's here, right now," the man said. "They're on their way," he said to the others as he slapped the phone closed. "We should shoot him," said one of the women. "Shoot him," said another woman while reaching up to touch one earring. "Who's got a gun?" asked a man with a broad white mustache and narrow head. "We've got lots," said a younger man with short hair and long dark sideburns. He put up a hand and said, "Everyone stay put," as he hopped into a sprint toward his house. Em got up, walked a few steps toward his neighbors. "You're going to shoot me?" he asked, still plucking eggshells from his shirt. A short, stocky man from two doors north nodded. "Thinking about it," an athletic middle-aged woman in pigtails stepped to the front. "Because," Em began. "Because you are dangerous," hollered a large woman in bare feet, her face turning red. "You are evil," she hummed. The words seemed to come out of her large eyes, pinned on Em. "You are the evil big one, asshole, crap turd." Em heard jingling, clinking, and scraping. Looked to see his neighbor hustling over, trying to carry a shotgun, two rifles, and a hunting knife in his teeth. Em walked up another couple of steps and watched the man pass out the weapons. "Some are going to have to share," he said, hurrying to getting everything arranged, dropping shells and bullets on the sidewalk, losing them in the grass, scrambling to match the right ammunition with the right weapon. "Somebody go first," said the woman with the skinning knife. "We need an icebreaker," someone said. "Someone shoot him. I don't think I should stab him first. That would come later." "Of course," another nodded in agreement. "I agree," said another. One of the men raised a rifle to his shoulder and aimed at M's face. M stared back like a deer, unsure of what he was seeing. A siren cried out. A black and white police car squealed around the corner. And that's the news from Moon Rock Lake, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the journalists and Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average. And that brings us very close to the end of another New American Dream radio show. We thank you for listening tonight. We hope you'll be back next week and every week right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com or at revolution.radio. Or you can also listen at newdream.us. And Mike, thank you and good night. Mike. Well, we may have a problem with Mike here. Maybe something happened to the phone. So let me
Chuck,
just...
Chuck,
oh,
Chuck.
Oh, you are. Okay.
It was the old mute thing.
Oh, that's happened to me many times. Thanks, Mike.
Okay. Thank you, Chuck, for all you do, all the interviews, the technical work, everything that makes this show possible. And thanks to our guests, Thomas Wortman, Richard Flamer, Jim Fetzer, Phil Ferruccio, and Frank Rodero. Please visit the New American Dream website, where you will find information about all of our regular guests and also the show archives. Newdream.us, also Penn Magazine, P-E-N-N Magazine.us. If you would like to donate to the Des Moines Catholic Worker, write to the Phil Berrigan House, 713 Indiana Avenue, Des Moines, Iowa, 50314. And while I don't have the address for the Chiapas Catholic Worker, they are affiliated. So I'm thinking that if you want to contact Richard Flamer in Chiapas, I think you can also write to him at the Des Moines Catholic Worker. And so good night to my friends, Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Don Hawksprung. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Muhammad Atta. Good night, Omar Mateen. Good night, Noah Posner. Good night, Crystal Campbell. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
If my words did glow with the gold of sunshine, and my tunes were played on the harp unstrung, would you hear my voice come through the music? Would you hold it near as it were your own? It's a hand-me-down. The thoughts are broken. Perhaps they're better left unsung. I don't know. Don't really care. Let there be songs to fill the air. Ripple in still water. When there is no pebble toss nor wind to blow, reach out your hand. If your cup be empty, if your cup is full, may it be again, let it be known. There is a fountain that was not made by the hands of men. There is a road, no simple highway, between the dawn and the dark of night. And if you go, no one may follow. That path is for your steps alone. Ripple in still water. When there is no pebble toss nor wind to blow, you choose to lead, must follow. But if you fall, you fall alone. If you should stand, then who's to guide you? If I knew the way, I would take you home. La-da-da-da-da. La-da-da-da-da.
Being foreclosed, people working 2-3 jobs just to put food on the table and still drowning in debt. Don't get me wrong. This country was founded on great ideals and principles. They've all been ruined by the banks. Open your eyes to the banks that are robbing you. You know who my favorite president was?
Who?
Thomas Jefferson. Because he saw all of this coming and tried to stop it. He fought the banks. JFK too, and they killed him for it. The banking institution is more dangerous than an army, he said. He also said that every generation needs a revolution, Jimmy. The American dream is just that. Just a dream. War is a continuation of politics, only by other means. Politics is a continuation of economics by other means.
This is our bank. This is our war. And this is our plan of attack.
Banks have become an essential threat to our democracy. So consider this justice.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio! Safe? Do you have the necessary information to assist you in confidently living through just about any survival situation? Is survival and gardening, off-grid living, medical knowledge, or even natural or man-made EMPs on your list of personal concerns? Do you have your documents and your personal information in a safe place in your hands where you know where it is? Well, check out our preloaded EMP-proof thumb drive. Over 3 gigs of survival documents and how-tos, plus the USDA offline food preservation website, and much, much more, including a surprise bonus we just can't tell you about here. With plenty of room left over to store your most important documents, imagine if a megavirus or a computer failure took out your bank, or all the banks for that matter. Are your banking records safe in your hands? So when they get things fixed and repaired, you can say,